It's Election Day. We get a brief update from the polls. Also, Miami schools relax mask requirements. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Voters in numerous cities across South Florida will vote on mayors or city officials or even new laws. Voter turnout in elections like these is usually low. We'll get an update from the field. Also, Miami-Dade schools are relaxing mask requirements. Is this a trend to putting masks behind for good? And an update on the investigation into the Surfside condo collapse. Could a construction project next door have led to damage to the Champlain Towers? And finally, using robot cats to help people with dementia. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. It's Election Day for some of South Florida's biggest cities. We know early voting turnout around the region has been low. Voters in Broward and Palm Beach counties are deciding who will move forward in the race to fill a congressional seat. In Miami-Dade, there are a handful of mayoral races and the launch of a possible new city. Well, two of the most hot-button issues are in Miami Beach. Voters will decide if they will re-elect two-term mayor Dan Gelber and whether bars should be banned from selling alcohol after 2 a.m. Joining me now is WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia. She's at some of the polls in Miami Beach. Veronica, what are you seeing out there? What's going on?
Hi, Luis. Well, I am seeing, unfortunately, not many people out. I am currently at Miami Beach City Hall, which is one of the polling places. And then I was just before at the Botanical Gardens voting place. And I'm not seeing many people, but it's starting to pick up a little bit now that maybe people are taking a lunch break and coming out to vote.
And what's the weather like out there right now? Is that, has that played a role?
It does. It's raining. It's been raining pretty much all morning. But, you know, it's not terrible. So I don't want to excuse people for not coming out. I think with an umbrella, it's doable. And maybe just replace the flip-flops with closed-toed shoes and you should be okay. It's not so terrible. But that is likely one reason people are not coming out.
So have you had a chance to talk to any voters? I'm wondering what are they talking about and thinking about right now?
Yes, I have. I just spoke to one voter who said she's friends with an owner of the Deuce Bar in Miami Beach, and she's very close with bartenders and is very much against the 2 a.m. The referendum that would, if passed, it would move up the last call for alcohol from 5 a.m. to 2 a.m. And it's one of those issues that as I speak to people and have been speaking to people, over these last few weeks, that it's, you either are completely for it or completely against, but there's no real middle ground. Like you said, they're coming out to either vote for the mayor or vote for vote on this particular issue.
And on the last call issue, do you get a sense of where people are leaning? Are they leaning more towards the 2 a.m. last call or keeping things the same?
You know, I can just base it off of the people I've spoken to seem to, they're telling me that the increase in crime in Miami Beach is not caused by people who are going out to a bar at 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. They say that, you know, those are not people who come out of the bar and then pull out a gun and are involved in gun violence. And so I have heard quite a bit people feeling like that's not the main issue. A lot of people are supporting more police presence, even though, you know, during the spring break, we saw a lot of police presence here, but they feel like it's not really uniform. And so they just feel frustrated. They feel like it's like a way for the commissioners to seem like they're going to do something on crime, and it's not really what they think is the answer. And I even spoke to one person who came out to vote. His name is Fabian Basabe, and he said he's so kind of angry about this issue that he wants to be on the ballot in 2023. So it's, some people are feeling really motivated about what's going on in Miami Beach.
No, that is taking it to another level when you're ready to run yourself. What about
That's
the re-election for Mayor Dan Gelber? How's that looking?
Well, there are several candidates who are, he has four, no, sorry, five people who are running against him. And the thing with these elections, when there's, it's not a presidential or a gubernatorial election, maybe people might be going on a name that they're, there's, you know, the people who are going with the name they're familiar with. Dan Gelber has also been in the legislature, and he's someone who's been involved in politics for a very long time. But this voter that I just spoke to, who said she's voting against the 2 a.m. Referendum, she said she's voting for Jean Maria Echemendia, who I also spoke to. She was here. She's running for mayor. And she said that she's Cuban-American, the candidate, Echemendia, and she said that she's against government controlling private businesses and what time they can be open. So, I know we hate to say it's only time will tell in journalism, but we are going to have to see kind of how this progresses throughout the day.
And the other thing, just as a reminder to voters, I wonder, you know, what's the situation when they show up to vote? How do they have it set up? Because I know the last time we had such strict COVID restrictions, and I'm wondering, is that something that they're still, you know, they're still going to face? Like, they have to wear masks, they're going to be social distancing, or what's the deal?
I am seeing people here at the City Hall. They're wearing masks, so you should certainly come out with a mask. And the voting is from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Nobody expects lines, unfortunately, in this election. But if you are in a line and, you know, at 7 p.m., you're not going to be turned away. And some of the identification you want to bring could be a Florida driver license or a U.S. passport, military identification, a license to carry a concealed weapon, a student identification. So you definitely want to have your ID with you and certainly come out and cast your ballot.
And the other thing, too, just wondering, what other races are you watching right now?
Well, I think it's really interesting to follow what happens with Biscayne Gardens. That issue would be whether it should become its own city rather than remain an unincorporated area run by Miami-Dade County. And opponents say that it's going to increase their taxes. It's not necessarily a high-income area, and so people worry about that. But then supporters say they don't have a supermarket, and there are 35,000 people who live there, more or less, and they want to have good roads to drive on, and they want to have a supermarket, and they want to have maybe some chain restaurants, and they feel that if they become their own city, they'll have more services, and the supporters are willing to pay more taxes to have those services and not feel forgotten. That's what the supporters are saying. So I think that'll be really interesting as a lifelong Floridian to see whether there'll be another city in our region here.
Yeah, there are a lot of conversations around South Florida about new cities possibly forming, but that one, as you pointed out, something important to think about. And again, folks, I know it's not a gubernatorial race, it's not a presidential race. Still, elections are important, and you know, we're making decisions on people and laws that will have an effect on our lives. Veronica Zaragovia out at the Miami Beach polls, thank you so much. I appreciate the insight.
Of course. Thank you so much.
And by the way, you can keep following all of the election updates throughout the day. Again, polls close at 7 p.m. Just follow it on our website, WLRN.org. All right, now I want to turn things over to the conversation about the latest fight over masks in schools here in South Florida. Miami-Dade school officials relaxed mask protocols as of yesterday. Superintendent Alberto Carvalho announced that high school and middle school students can now opt out of the district's mask mandate. Well, joining us now is Miami Herald reporter David Goodhue. David, the change in protocol is only for middle and high school students. What about elementary school students?
Elementary school students still have to wear masks. The parents cannot opt them out of the policy. That said, Carvalho said if the trend in cases keeps cases, hospitalizations, and deaths still continue to come down, that could change within weeks. And relax the policy for even elementary school students.
And who is the superintendent being advised? Who's advising him? Where is he? You know, how is he making this decision?
He's making the decision based on the recommendations by an ad hoc committee of area doctors.
All right. So how do parents and these students, again, middle and high school students, How do they opt out? What's the process?
All they have to do is there's a form available on the school district's website, and it can be picked up in any it can be picked up physically in any of the schools. All they have to do is fill that out and turn it in, and there's no questions asked.
You know, David, I'm curious how schools have been enforcing this in the first place, and you know, moving forward, you know, do they have the resources, you know, to really enforce and make sure that everybody who's opted out is able to do so? I mean, how's that been working?
So far, according to district officials, that they haven't really had much of a problem enforcing it or needing to enforce it. Most of the students have been pretty cooperative. And even now, you know, a lot of students, I mean, it's only been a day, but in Broward, it's been since last week that they had the option of the high school students had the option of not wearing masks, and a lot of students continue to wear them.
The fact that elementary school students still have to for now, is that a challenge to the governor's ban on mandating masks?
The state got back to me yesterday and they said they have not had time at the time that they had not had a chance to completely look at what they'd was planning. So they didn't say if the district was within the law in complying with the executive orders.
Now we have seen that the state, specifically the Florida Department of Education, they took action against some of the counties that had pushed forward mass mandates going against the governor's executive order, punishing those districts, taking away salaries from school board members, and even when the federal government got involved, trying to take money away from those districts as punishment. Did the Department of Education do anything against Miami-Dade County schools when they put in their mass mandates?
As of yesterday, Carvalho said no, they haven't.
All right, so we don't know, though, if they're going to, because you, as you said, you had spoken to the state. We don't know yet if they might still punish the district for what any mandates that they've had up to this point.
Yes, and Carvalho said with the new easing of the mask mandates, in his view, it brings the district two-thirds of the way in compliance with DeSantis' order.
Has the school district started talking about vaccines? Because we know they're available for certain age kids, but they might soon, even up to this week, be available for all children. Has that been a conversation at all?
Yes. They're still encouraging vaccinations, even though vaccination rates among eligible Miami-Dade school children is pretty high. It's I think 80% of those eligible students have at least one of the jabs, and 60% are fully vaccinated. But he still wants more vaccinations. And yesterday, Carvalho said that they were going to look into making more places in schools available where people can actually get the vaccine.
And do we know about vaccination rates with teachers and staff?
He said it's pretty high in the 70s and 80s as well. They have no way of, legally they can't ask for verification though. But he thinks the honor system's working.
So is it fair to assume that, you know, he's still waiting to hear from this group of experts as to when we can just totally relax all masks wearing in schools on any campus at all? And that, I mean, not just students, everybody.
Yeah, that task force continues to advise him, and yes, he's going to rely on their advice.
What do we know about the other counties around us? Palm Beach, Broward, Monroe, are they pretty much following suit? Because it seemed like during this entire pandemic, Miami-Dade kind of led the way, and they usually would make the decision, and then everybody else kind of followed.
Yeah, I know. Actually, Monroe did not. They from the beginning technically had a mask mandate, but it was still a parental opt-out option. It wasn't truly a mandate.
So again, a reminder that all middle school and high school students can opt out And just one more time, what did the superintendent, what did Carvalho say about when possibly all elementary school students might also be able to opt out?
He said by the end of this week, based on the numbers that come from the State Department of Health, if the trend continues to be favorable, like it looks like it's going to be, he could even make an announcement as soon as next week sometime on when parents may be able to opt their elementary school students out of the mandate as well.
I've been talking with the Miami Herald reporter David Goodhue, talking about Miami-Dade County School District relaxing its mask protocol for some students, not all students. Again, those who were in middle and high school now can opt out of wearing a mask. And by the way, if you want to see more of his reporting on this, you could find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Also, we'll have information there, as David pointed out, how to opt out if you want your kid to opt out of having to wear a mask. David, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you.
Now, don't forget, coming up in 20 minutes or so, we're going to look at a study where they use robot cats to help dementia patients. But first, a new investigation into the Surfside tragedy could be linked to construction done right next door. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The reason why the Champlain Tower South Surfside collapse may not be known for a while, but little by little, new information is coming out to help us understand what happened. The Miami Herald reported one of them this week, and we're joined now by Sarah Blasky to get the latest. Sarah, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So there are questions now, according to this latest story that you published about construction that was going on right next door of some luxury condos. What was that project?
Right. So there was a luxury 18-story condo building being put up between 2016 and 2019, just next door to the south of Champlain South Towers. And as they were drilling for the foundation, pile driving, there were significant vibrations to the ground. This building is very, very close to Champlain South. And as a result, there have always been questions from residents of Champlain Towers about the vibrations that they felt. They complained at the time in 2016, 2017, 2018, saying that, they felt their walls shaking, dishes would rattle, that kind of thing. But of course, humans perceive vibrations very quickly. But the actual, sort of intensity of those vibrations, even if a human can feel them, it doesn't mean that they are intense enough to harm a concrete structure. That said, the Miami Herald just exclusively obtained a report from the development itself, from the development company that says at the time they knew they had exceeded conservative vibration limits at the southern edge of the Champlain South property. And that really calls into question how much damage could have been done by those vibrations.
And they were with so the, what they were doing was they were driving metal sheets. Is that what that's what you're reporting into the ground? What exactly and really close to the pool area for Champlain Towers. What exactly though, where were they piling in there? And when you say driving them in, causing vibrations, like is that a constant noise over a long period of time or short bursts? What was going on?
Certainly, it depends on how you drive piles, what kind of vibration it would cause, but short bursts, pulsing might be the way you would describe the type of vibration. In this case, sheet piles, which is what was being driven at the time of monitoring, they were driving sheet piles about 12 feet off of the southern perimeter of the Champlain Tower South structure. Sheet piles are basically an underground retaining wall that you put into the ground in order to kind of contain construction of a new building, contain vibrations, contain water flow, contain all kinds of things as you're building a building and protect the buildings around you. But as they're driving these kind of metal retaining walls underground, it can cause vibrations. And And what their reading showed, and their readings were based on sensors that were placed along the southern perimeter wall of the Champlain South pool deck, which is part of the critical structure, right? The southern perimeter wall is a structural element of this building that the slab, the floor, the first floor connects to. Basically, what their monitoring devices said was that the ground was shaking between 0.5 and 1 inches per second, that's what the ground was moving while they were driving these piles. And depending on which agency that you look at, mining standards would say, well, those are still low vibration levels. But standards by the Federal Transit Administration would say, well, anything above a 0.5 inch per second movement could damage structural concrete. And so that's what's coming out now is how much could that have damaged, particularly these areas of Champlain South that were part of the pool deck and that southern perimeter wall and the connection there.
And as you said, a lot of the residents of Champlain Towers had been complaining, you know, for those few years of construction about noise and about the dust, the construction dust everywhere, but specifically about that vibration, that there was stuff in their house moving like it was an earthquake.
Right. And again, humans perceive vibrations at much lower levels than would do damage to the structural integrity of any building. We're very sensitive to vibrations. And so someone saying they could feel it, someone saying their dishes were rattling, does not necessarily indicate that these levels were above, any level that would create structural damage. However, this report that, again, was commissioned by the developers of this condominium project next to Champlain South, their own report said that the vibrations exceeded the threshold that they were hoping to maintain. So their vibrations were higher than that conservative threshold that they thought would mean that the building next door was, you know, not going to be harmed in any way, superficially or otherwise. And that also, you know, it had levels that were high enough based on the standards from some agencies that were high enough to damage structural concrete.
Yeah, I wondered, like, the engineers that you had spoken with, how confident are they that those levels of vibration could have, because there's still questions as to whether the construction of the Champlain Towers was done right to begin with. And we're not going to know this for some time, but how confident are these engineers that maybe that vibration could have done some damage?
We certainly know that Champlain Towers South was not constructed even by the building codes of the time. It was not constructed correctly. There are various things that are evident within the plans as engineers look at the building plans from 1980, 1981, when this building was constructed, that weren't right. This building had too much stress on certain elements. Its columns were too narrow and too far apart. These findings have been reported by the Miami Herald and other publications. And so certainly this building was under pressure from the start. Then add to that degradation over time, salty air and water that really corrodes concrete and the reinforcing steel within that concrete, kind of the bones of the building, and then shoddy repair work that's evident in permits. There are lots of things that went wrong at Champlain South. And that's what experts have told us from day one, is a nearly unprecedented collapse like this will be the perfect storm of, you know, what caused it will be the perfect storm of circumstances. Part of it will be design, part of it will be degradation over time. And then, you know, what else contributed? And so certainly these vibrations, if they did do damage, and our experts think that it's more likely that they exacerbated pre-existing damage in the building, if anything at all. But if they did do damage, you know, how much of the overall picture would that be responsible for? And we really just don't know yet what exactly was the contribution, if anything. And that remains to be seen.
We're talking with Sarah Blasky from the Miami Herald. And again, the latest story looks at the construction of a luxury condo built next to the Champlain Towers a few years ago. And if during that construction, some of the work that was being done had created a vibration, it created, possibly a vibration that caused any damage to the Champlain Towers, as she said, we don't know. But find a link to that story. Check it out. It's at our social media, WLRN Sundial. Sarah, I wanted to come back to this report. And because, again, the Miami Herald got the exclusive on this. Where did the report come from?
So the report is from a company called NV5, which subcontracted to a company called Geosonics. And they were working for the development at 8701 Collins. So this 18-story luxury condo development project at 8701. And any developer across Miami-Dade County, the Florida Building Code says that the developer is responsible for making sure that their construction project does not cause damage to any buildings around it. And so one of the ways that developers will ensure that is by monitoring the vibrations of their construction over time, you know, just to make sure they're within range. And so that's what NV5 and Geosonics were doing at this point. This is March 2016, 5 years ago. And they were monitoring, you know, the construction that was closest to the building in terms of driving piles, you know, the deep construction, the ones known to cause vibrations. They're monitoring that, and they are creating a report for the developers, for the development team of 8701 to say, okay, here's the levels of vibration that your construction project caused. And what their report says is you did exceed the limits in all but 6 of your 35 readings along that southern wall. You did exceed the limits that we set, 0.5 inches per second, but you did not exceed 1 inch per second. And so we believe, and this is the company that they contracted to do this, those engineers said they didn't believe that there was any reason to think that there was structural damage to Champlain South based on the readings that they got. So they exceeded, but the engineers of record on that report did not think that any further action was warranted because the readings weren't as high as they thought they should have been to sort of be a major red flag.
Do we know if this information, any of the information from this report, is being used or could be used in the lawsuits that are underway?
Well, that's exactly right. So this report was turned over this week to attorneys who are representing various individuals who either lived in the building or, you know, owned something in the building or family members. There are about, you know, I'm throwing a number out there, maybe 40 lawsuits going on individually and otherwise that have all been sort of put under the umbrella of a receivership case. And in that, this company, the development group behind 8701, has been named, and they had to turn over this document as part of that legal process. And so they have not been named in a class action lawsuit yet. But they have been named in a handful of individual lawsuits alleging some sort of fault or some sort of blame in this, tragedy that killed 98 people in Surfside earlier this year.
And, of course, the investigation that's underway to figure out what exactly happened, how that collapse happened. Is this report going to get into their hands at some point?
Sure. And I don't have personal knowledge of if it has already or not, but the federal investigators with the National Institute of Standards and Technology will look at all available information and they will, as they try to determine what went wrong and why this happened. And I think certainly a construction project next door is something that they would be interested in. Although I do want to point out, 5 years is a long time. So when we're thinking about a collapse, we're looking for a trigger, you know, that final straw that broke the camel's back, as they say, in addition to all of the conditions that allowed that, you know, the building to get to that point, the brink of collapse in the first place. And something 5 years ago could not be a trigger. That's what experts are telling us, right? So NIST will not be looking at this. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, will not be looking at this as the potential trigger, but they might be looking at it as a potential contributing factor, and that perhaps could have implications for monitoring on construction sites and et cetera in the future.
Is there anything else that could come from this report?
You mean in terms of...
I don't know if there's anything else to discover from this report or, you know, from what you guys have already reported on it.
This report is fairly narrow. Again, it covers a 10-day span of time in March of 2016. But I think there is probably more to learn about the development project in general. The construction lasted between 2016 and 2019, and construction is known to cause vibration and damage. And so I think as these lawsuits play out, you may be hearing more about this development project and maybe seeing more documentation about what was really going on there.
Sarah Blasky again with the Miami Herald. Check out their latest report that just came out again, looking at the construction of a tower next to Champlain Southside Towers. Did it play a role in any way? Really fascinating information coming out of there. Find a link to that story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Sarah, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, we'd always love to hear from you. And one of the best ways that you can get in touch with us, whether you have some comments or questions about a story like this, is join our Sundial Text Club. Just text us the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. That's the easiest way to do it. And this is the easiest way to get a hold of us because, again, maybe you have comments about this story, something you may know, and you could share it with us that way. Well, still to come, can robot cats help patients with dementia and Alzheimer's? We'll find out. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know, playing with a puppy or kitten is a sure way to put a smile on someone's face. Some dogs, cats, and other animals serve as therapy pets to ease debilitating mental illnesses like anxiety and depression. But what about people with dementia or Alzheimer's? These memory loss diseases make it hard to take care of a pet. So researchers at Florida Atlantic University looked into robotic pets. All right, now that's the sound of a robot cat. They found that these battery-powered stuffed animals can have positive effects on their patients. Dr. Lisa Kirk-Wiese is an associate professor at FAU's Christine E. Lynn College of Nursing, and she joins us now to talk about this research. Dr. Wiese, that's amazing. That's a robot that we just heard.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here today to talk with you a little bit about it, Wiese.
Describe this cat for me, because this is not like a little robot. It looks a lot more like a cat than people would think.
It's surprising. To determine which type of cat to use, my student, Brianna Strait-LaRose, this was her project, we ordered three what they call toy pets from toy companies. And we found that this particular one, I'll have to put a plug in for them, Ageless Innovation, that cat was so realistic. It felt furry. It sounded, as you could hear on your recording, like a cat. And it responds to touch. When you pet the back, it will turn its head and blink and look up at you. You pet the belly, it turns over. Pet the paws, it'll do... Other interactive responses. And this seemed to be what captured our clients at the Memory and Wellness Center, headed by Dr. Maria Ortega, who was the community chair on this project.
And I'm just going to mention, too, by the way, we'll share a video on our social media, WLRN Sundial. So you could see a video of this cat and how it moves. You know, somebody's petting it and all the things you said, how this little robot reacts to you. But where did the idea to use this cat for dementia patients come from?
Well, you touched on that, Luis. It was really because we knew that animals have a wonderful effect on humans in general with emotion, mood, even cognition, stress, you know, with veterans. We have a researcher at FAU that does a lot of terrific work with using live animals with veterans. But we wanted to do something that would be realistic for persons with cognitive impairment. And Brianna and I, the student, were sitting around talking, what could we do? And we came up with this idea, but maybe a robotic animal would work. But when we looked into it, all we saw were robotic seals from Japan that were thousands of dollars. So we just sort of brainstormed and came up with the idea to try these available toy pets out. And it really had such a surprising success to what we were hoping to achieve, you know, which was to improve emotions and mood.
I think about, look, Alzheimer's and dementia has affected so many people, affected my family. My grandmother had it, but she did have a dog that was always at her side. It affected your family. Mm. Alzheimer's affected your family, didn't it? Right?
Yes, it did. Absolutely. My mother had Alzheimer's disease. Right.
And how did that diagnosis, her diagnosis, influence your work?
Thank you for asking that. It was interesting because back in 2010, when there wasn't quite as much buzz about Alzheimer's disease, we noticed that she was having extreme short-term memory loss. She would keep asking the same question over and over again. So we took her to a primary care provider who immediately recognized that might be Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and had her evaluated and put her on two common medications to treat it. And for 7 years, she did not progress beyond that short-term memory loss in her cognition. She didn't go down that slippery slope of all the horrible manifestations and behaviors that you can see with Alzheimer's disease that make it so challenging. And I decided then that I wanted to do some kind of research that would let people know about how important it is to be screened for Alzheimer's disease early and often. And as I developed my program at FAU, I was mentoring students. And as the rest, as you know, you've talked about, what led to these robotic pets as an intervention.
You and your team conducted 12 visits at an adult daycare day center to see the effectiveness of these robot cats on the patients. First, let's start with this. How did you introduce the patients to these cats?
So first of all, I want to just preface it by saying that the staff at the Memory Wellness Center were a very integral part of this study because they identified people who they felt might be responsive to an intervention like this. And then they contacted the caregivers because we needed to have consent from the family member or the caregiver, as well as the person working with the pet, you know, the attendee at the Memory and Wellness Center. And so from there, the Memory and Wellness Center incorporated an activity time to where the participants who were in this study would then be pulled from a different engaging activity to participate in this robotic cat exercise. And we handed out the robotic cats, and we used only cats because we did not want to have people saying, I want a dog or I want a cat, although dogs are available. And we would hand it out to them and say, we're going to give you this cat to just play with and interact while you're here today. And if you want, you can name your cat. All of them wanted to name their cat, and all of them then received. Brianna had the idea to make a collar with a name tag for the cat, because of course they would not remember what they named their cat. And then we had them tell us stories about any pets that they might have had, or maybe that they wish they had had. And it was quite engaging to see them come alive from sitting there just not doing a lot in the chair, and to come alive with embracing the cat, petting the cat, smiling, laughing, talking to their neighbor that was sitting next to them, say, oh, look at your cat. Oh, look at my cat. It was amazing.
You know, the one of the things that I was thinking about is, they understood this wasn't a real cat, right? It was a robot, but yet they're reacting and treating it, naming it like it's a real animal.
That's right. And we, you know, you We gave this to some people in the community when COVID-19 hit. Another student did a virtual outreach with cats. And it really did not work with people who were cognitively intact. You know, they would say, oh, that's cute, you know, but I don't have time for this or whatever. But for people who have mild to moderate dementia, it didn't seem to matter that it wasn't real. It was evoking the response as if they were real, and that emotion and feeling like they connected with the cat is what was important.
And what did you learn from, you know, again, conducting these visits? What did you learn about how this is helping the patients more maybe than any medication, or is it still important to have that medication there? I wonder what the benefits are, is what I want to get at.
Thank you for asking that. You know, people with dementia, and we always say it like that instead of like dementia patients, because the person underneath is still a person, right? So it's person with a disease. So the person with dementia, the symptoms that they may be having and behaviors can be really hard to control with medications. And they often have a lot of side effects that you don't really want. You know, they're very sleepy. You know, they don't really respond as well as you'd like. And so I think that before you go down the road of a psychotherapeutic drug, for example, you could try something like this. We know that music is really effective for, you know, managing behaviors in persons with dementia. And so if you were to take this robot and when they're being aggressive or, you know, that they're being depressed or they're not interacting, you know, instead of giving them the pill right away, try giving them the robotic cat. Well, they did that at the Memory and Wellness Center, by the way, Luis, when they had an aggressive patient one day after the study was over. We had donated a couple of the cats. They got the idea to grab the cat and go sit with the person in a separate room quietly, and they were able to deflect that anger and the aggressiveness in the person, and it really worked nicely.
That is amazing. Again, it's a robotic cat. It's as you said, it's really like a toy,
right?
But it reacts. It reacts. You touch it, you pet it, it moves. Its eyes move. It can purr. It actually, I saw the video. It purrs. It moves like a cat. It is, I'd imagine because it looks furry that it also feels like a cat as well. And again, I want to mention that we have a video on our social media, so you can look at this and see what we're talking about. And I'm talking again with Dr. Lisa Kirk-Wiese, an associate professor at FAU's College of Nursing, studying the effects of these robotic cats acting as therapeutic companions for people with dementia and Alzheimer's. Dr. Wiese, you know, I wondered, you know, because you said earlier that there are dogs as well, but is there a reason why are cats more preferable?
It was just our personal choice, because when we looked at the two, we thought the cat looked more realistic.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. You know, I wanted to get to this too, because you had mentioned, you started to touch on this earlier, but the importance, I just want to remind people of the importance of an early diagnosis for diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's, and why that is so important.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because recently in the last several years, we have identified 14 risk factors that are modifiable, meaning things you can do to decrease your risk. So we also know that the amyloid plaques and tau tangles that often lead to Alzheimer's disease, which is the most common type of dementia, can start 20 years prior to the symptoms. So it's important to not only be managing behaviors that can decrease risk, but also to get a baseline cognitive evaluation. So over time, if you get evaluated every year, you can start to see declines before you would possibly see someone doing a behavior.
And what do we know right now about who's more at risk for developing these diseases?
So we do know that persons, of course, it's age related. So the older you are, the more risk you have. So right now, Medicare, Medicaid sponsor a free annual wellness visit that involves a cognitive screening in persons 65 and over. We know that people who have less education, people who are racially and ethnically diverse, people who are isolated and less socially engaged, people who have increased blood pressure readings and diabetes. Even now we know that dental, oral health, people with poor dentition and oral health and are all increases your risk for Alzheimer's disease, and including there is genetic base too. It doesn't mean you're absolutely going to get it. For example, my mother had Alzheimer's disease, as you know. So we tested for the APOE4 gene, which can indicate increased risk. And she did not have it. But even if she did, it didn't mean that I would necessarily get it. So there's a lot of good reasons to be aware of what you can do to decrease your risk.
And, you know, it is, again, when you start to see your family members as they're aging, what are some of the things that you should be looking for?
So the most common symptom in Alzheimer's disease is the inability to create a new memory. So if you have someone who's asking you the same question ever again, or repeating the same thing ever again, and they don't remember what they just saw you, that's usually very indicative. But there's other types of dementia, you know, vascular dementia, which is, you know, related to the cardiovascular health of someone, where you may see them word searching, you know, they can't find the word, or they replace the word with something else. We may have where you have extreme mood swings or something that where they're suddenly aggressive. That can be another type of dementia. We see that with behavior management issues that are unique in Parkinson's disease. So if you have any doubt at all, it's always best to get evaluated, you know, and just, you know, talk to your loved one to say, hey, you know, I want to keep your brain healthy, you know, I want to help you do that. So let's go, talk to the doctor and find out, you know, what we can do to help keep your brain healthy. If you put it in terms of that, then they're more likely to go with you to be evaluated. Like a memory wellness center, the University of Miami Comprehensive Brain Health Center is there. The Florida Atlantic University has a wonderful memory wellness center run by nurses that does all kinds of testing. And, you know, you can put it in terms of that rather than saying, I want to get you checked for dementia,
right,
or I think you have Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
There are ways to frame it.
Yeah, sometimes just saying those words could be very scary for a lot of
right.
people. In looking at the research that you've done so far, where do you think this can go? Beyond maybe robot cats and dogs, maybe to something else. Where do you think this can lead to?
Well, I think, you know, improving emotion is really important. We were able to show in the study there was correlation between the mood and emotion scales and the person's cognitive state. So I think continuing to look at that, we do know that socialization makes a difference. People who have increased socialization have improved cognitive scores on studies. So I think, continuing to try to fund these simple means of decreasing risk and improving cognitive function are going to be really important as our population ages, especially in Florida, where we have the second highest percentage of older adults in the country.
Mm. And how much longer are you going to continue with using the cats? And are you going to expand that to, again, maybe something else?
We don't have plans to really expand it beyond trying to reach a larger audience. So, like, we knew it worked with this memory and wellness setting. We did it virtually and we knew that it worked in 9 of the 12 homes that we targeted. You know, I'd like to see this go to broader audiences, you know, especially underserved, where they don't have access to, you know, a lot of therapy many times. This might be a wonderful way to help diminish the risk, which ultimately decreases the burden on our healthcare system in those underserved communities.
Have we seen this? Anybody else been doing anything like this? Does the state have a program like this?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. The Florida Department of Elder Affairs has a wonderful program where you can call them or fill out an online application to have a robotic cat mailed to you.
Wow.
Because they've realized the importance of it. So I think it's an opportunity that people should take advantage of.
And you
It's
know
one.
what? We'll put a link to that as well on our social media so people can learn more about it. Dr. Lisa Kirk Wiese, Associate Professor at FAU's College of Nursing. This is a fascinating, fascinating story. I really appreciate you sharing with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you, your respective voice in South Florida, always.
Well, thank you so much for that. And as Dr. Wiese said, you know what? It's something to think about for your family, for yourself, getting those regular checkups because early detection is really so important. And you know, I think this is just so cool. I know we always think about robots and the future and it's scary. No, maybe robots might actually be really useful to helping us in the future. Just think about that. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, November 2nd. Coming up tomorrow on the show, of course, with the elections, we're going to have possibly new mayors, new laws. We're going to take a look at all the results coming up tomorrow, plus a new exhibit in Key West. It takes us back to that magical time before the Keys became what we know of today. Back when, you know, drug smuggling was rampant, the Navy was leaving the area and big tourism hadn't hit yet. We're going to hear from a woman who has collected stories and photos of what Key West was before what it is now. Anyway, that's coming up tomorrow on the show. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.